Hey, you're still here at George Mason University. I'm here with Dr. Matthew Hodler from the University of Rhode Island. Today we are covering an article outside of necessarily like the normal health and physical education context that we usually talk about. But the article title is Converging Interests, Unequal Benefits, Tribal Critical Race Theory in the Miami University's Miamia Heritage Logo. This was published in the Sociology of Sport Journal with Callie Bats Maddox. You can find the full site of the article in the notes. Matt, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, and I love the paper because it's way out of what I typically would read, but it's also something that I've been kind of looking into a little bit more. I don't know if you've listened to these podcasts, This Land podcast that talks about Native Americans and these kind of couple Supreme Court lawsuits that have recently come up. It's really interesting. We cover Native American in sports and physical education in class that I teach. So this is really interesting. So I'm interested to find out what's your background to the study? Like, what's the history behind this that kind of led you to writing a paper about this?
We've been talking about the tomahawk chop in my classes this week too. So I've been thinking extra about this work. Hmm. It's a long history. I grew up all over the country and we lived in Oklahoma for a little bit. And when I was there, was kind of at that formative age of like 8 till 10, you know, when you start to remember things. And I took a few Native American history classes, and we would do a celebration of the land run every spring, which is when white settlers came to Oklahoma and basically took over Indian territory, is the short reason for that. And so the politics of Native Americans and Native American history has been something that's been pretty interesting to me throughout my life. When I chose to go to school, I went to undergrad at Miami, Ohio, which is the subject institution of this piece. Mm-hmm. And it was shortly after they'd switched the mascot name from the slur to Red Hawks.
Okay.
And when we got there, it was still a big issue on campus. Sherman Alexie came and spoke. The Summer Reed was the Lone Ranger and Tonto fist fight in heaven. We watched Smoke Signals, which was a movie based on Sherman Alexie's work. And there was I don't know if it's like this at George Mason or other schools that you've worked at or been to, but Miami, at least back then, would try to do like a series of other talks throughout the semester that related to the summer reading issue. So there was... Okay. Native American scholars would come in and talk about the history. And to be honest, when I came to Miami, one of the things I really liked the mascot name, and I thought that it was like this honorable thing. Mm-hmm. And then you hear indigenous people's perspectives, you read about the histories, you watch documentaries, and you start to learn about the genocide. I began to be very happy with switching the name to me. And this was kind of personified, or at the end of my freshman year, I swam in Miami for 1 year before I injured myself. And there was a fight when we won conference championships. They won, the older guys who had come in and recruited as the old name wanted to write that mascot or the slur on our rings. And the younger guys were always Red Hawks. Hmm. And so there was an argument about what would go on our rings. And it was a compromise. Where they would put the block M with the Indian with the chief head logo mm-hmm. on top, and so like that tension sort of always was interesting to me and always something that I kept my eyes open. I didn't really know how to think about it. So, you know, you go away, you graduate, I lived life, and then I went back to grad school, and my first job after my PhD was back at Miami as a visiting assistant professor, and by then that would have been about 15 or 20 years after the name had been changed. But I began to see remnants of the old name around campus. And Callie, Dr. Maddox, was also started at Miami as a tenure track professor when I was there. And she had the same kind of thing. And we taught similar classes. And so we would talk through, like, what are we doing in the classroom? And kind of a really collaborative work. And we started just thinking about how to bring in, I'm sure you do the same thing, but how do we make our students interested in these things?
Right.
And generally, if you talk about your local school, students are interested.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started asking students about it. And we then, as I think we say in the article, we then saw the Miami Heritage logo sort of emerge. I first noticed it on some of my students who are athletes' shirts, or administration would send out emails with that, the logo as their signature.
Mm-hmm.
Callie saw it on when she would go to the swim pool with her little daughter. You'd see stuff around campus, signage and those things as well. So we just started noticing it and noticed that change and those two logos side by side. And we wanted to figure out a way to talk about it and think about it in a complex way.
And it's interesting because we talked offline earlier that this is something that was really personal for you because you were an undergraduate there and then you came back and you've kind of opened your mind into understanding a lot of this. So it's something that you're living because you're actually on that campus and you're seeing this occurring.
But yeah. Exactly. And I'm sure you had the same thing with like my old friends from college will still talk about these things. And you know, you relive the same arguments over and over again, sometimes with the same people that you've been friends with for 20 years.
Yeah.
But it was that, exactly how you said, sort of re-inhabiting that space 20 years later kind of gives you a different language for the different perspective that you've developed over this time.
Yeah. And so you mentioned that the discussion about reinvocation of Native American imagery in sport hasn't really been studied. Can you explain what that term means and kind of give us an overview?
Yeah, definitely. We used the term reinvocation because it was sort of an organic, the Miami Heritage logo, which I think you can see the pictures of in the piece.
Yeah.
I think we have that. Yeah. On page 235 sort of came about, and it was not the it was not the official logo at the time of the M with the wings on it. That is the Miami official logo. But it was everywhere. And invocation to us had this sort of cultural aspect to it. So it wasn't just structural, where it was like slapped onto things. It also kind of called back or harkened back the old imagery usage.
Mm-hmm.
And so we settled on the word reinvocation because we thought that kind of made us like overcomplicate or made it, let me see the best way to say this. It called out the need to think about it as more than just the sticker on the side of a helmet.
Right.
Like that invocation, the reinvocation sort of spoke to the broader atmosphere. And we poked around and looked at other schools that had gotten rid of the mascots. So like Stanford, Dartmouth, what other ones?
What was Stanford's logo? Because they were in our conference. I always remember it as the Stanford Cardinal, and it was just like a tree, and I was always curious.
It was in the 70s. They mm-hmm. had a Native American mascot, and I think and it was like a mascot. It wasn't actually the imagery.
Uh-huh.
And then they switched over to the tree officially and the cardinal as a sort of just discussion of the color red. Because from the way that I always understood it and read it, it was that red was, you know, like sort of like St. John's used to be the red men.
Yeah, yeah.
And Syracuse used to be the orange men.
Yeah.
Like those were references towards Native Americans. And that's how, and Stanford is always written about as being one of the first schools to switch. And I want to say it was in the early 70s.
Something to look up for me later.
Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe it's something we should have put in the article. And so we were looking at those kinds of schools that had switched those. And, you know, our University of Oklahoma, the Sooners, which is one of the nicknames of the people that broke the line to jump ahead early on the land run,
mm-hmm.
Had a Native American mascot called Little Red, and they got rid of him. And there was no, and we haven't seen imagery used again in those schools. And we found it curious, especially when we looked at kind of the way that the new imagery was talked about. It was very similar to Jennifer Guliano's book, Indian Spectacle, looks at the 1920s, 1930s college football becoming a spectacle. And she looks at Native American mascots. And a lot of the press releases that talked about Native Americans back then, like Chief Lionawick was the, she looked a lot of the Midwest, and Chief Lionawick at Fighting a Lion Eye, they use similar sort of coming together around a campfire. We're using this Native American masquetry to represent a community, broader ideals, was very similar. And I think we talk about this, it kind of rhymes with the 1930s and 20s rhetoric,
right,
and language used in the 2010s, 2016, 2018, when we saw this being reemerged. And so that was another reason why we used reinvoked. And Miami was the only one that we could see doing that. But it also is important that Miami has a very unique relationship with the tribe that other schools don't seem to have.
Right.
Maybe Florida State and Seminole Tribe of Florida, which is one of the three federally recognized tribes, Seminole tribes, might have a similar relationship, but Miami had done some really fascinating work with some scholars to basically refurbish and refine and reanimate the language. So like the Miami language was dying, according to most folks that I've read. But they did some really good work and found it some really smart scholars, Baldwin being one of the, I think it's Doug Baldwin, but Baldwin is one of the first ones they did, and kind of helped to reanimate these interests in the culture in a really progressive and sort of positive way for a lot of folks that are scholars of Native Americans.
Yeah, and I think you have some images there in the paper as well, where they talk about this Heritage logo, and we'll get to that. But
yeah,
one of the ways that you used, I mean, you used a theory to analyze your work and analyze what was happening here, and it's called tribal critical race theory. And obviously, like somebody listening to this, they're going to catch on to that critical race theory if they've listened to any political podcast or watch the news. It's a very hot topic, and I'm sure that when you were writing this paper, because it was published in 2020, it didn't have the same pop politically. But so I'm wondering, like, I know some readers or some listeners might understand what critical race theory is, some people don't know, but what is tribal critical race theory? Because I haven't heard that before.
Definitely. Well, you're 100% right. It was CRT or critical race theory was not as big of a sort of political flashpoint at the time when we were writing this. And it, as you know, like basically it's a framework that places race and racism at the center of analysis. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to look at how race and racism are reproduced through structures. It originally came out of legal theory. And so it looked a lot like laws that were nominally colorblind, quote unquote, or didn't think about race, but then how do they reproduce racism?
Yeah.
Was it like Derek Bell and others sort of invented it or created it? Tribal critical race theory is an offshoot of that. And I didn't know about it either. Callie and I had been collecting all of this information, and we knew we wanted to write about this project. And we initially wrote, got invited to present in a really informal way at this workshop, a public history workshop that looked at university sports and campus sites. And we wrote and presented on the stadium, because the stadium had a big M with the Chief Head logo on it, which for a while was like a tertiary logo for the Miami University. It was always official, but not very often used. But it was this giant logo on the side of the wall. And we had a good conversation. We talked, but we didn't feel like we were really getting to the root of the complexities of this issue. And so we'd been digging around for some theory and to help us analyze it. And there are some good critical race theory scholars that look at sport as an institution, Kevin Hilton being one of them. We cite him a few times in here. But we didn't think that was getting to where we wanted to go, and we weren't sure what to do. And then Callie, I remember coming, she came to my office, and she basically assigned me the Brave Boy reading from 2005. And she said, I think this is the one that's going to help us kind of make sense of this, because of the theory of converging interests or interest convergence, mm-hmm. where we didn't know how to critique and think about this relationship in a complex way, because we knew that they were working with the Miamia tribe, and we also knew that there was some positive aspects of this relationship, and this theory kind of helps you deal with those complexities, and it lets you kind of think through how does the legacies of colonialism, because the tribal critical race theory, the difference between, or the main difference between tribal critical race theory and critical race theory is that TCRT, or tribal crit, mm-hmm. Looks at colonization and the continuing dominance of European American power structures and points of view or epistemologies.
Yeah, and that to me was an interesting kind of separation between the two, because when you think about it, there is, I mean, a lot of people in and around the world have been colonized, but in the U.S., it's very specifically Native Americans who have been colonized, and it continues to be like they are on federal, like, Indian land. They're living there, but there are still, like, this European American power structure surrounding them everywhere they go. So I found that, because you wrote in the paper that the CRT was this, like, black-white binary. So I could understand where you're like, oh, it works, but, you know, it doesn't necessarily work in working with Native American populations, or in this case, the you know, symbols for that group of people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself than what you just said. Like, those power structures are there. And having read and remembering some of those stories I read as a kid, but from Sherman Alexie, and when I was an 8, 9, 10-year-old kid, I kind of remembered, like, those sorts of stories about kids my age or high school kids running up into different points of view when they left the reservation or when they left sovereign land of their tribes. And that kind of helped me, just in a really simplistic way, remind myself of the use of tribal theory and that focus on colonization.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and I don't know about you, if you feel this way, and I don't want to impose this on you, so don't let me, but I often, or too often, in my writing, but also in my teaching, when we talk about race, like, have those specific race, I mean, we're always talking about race in one way or the other, but in those very specific units on race, I oftentimes fall into that black-white binary and forget about that vast center. So I was very grateful and happy for, like, for this theory, because it did help us get to that one.
Yeah.
Get to the meat of the issue.
So what was the meat of the issue? And this great segue right there into your methods. So this was a study, right? So what was the study? What did you do?
Well, we pretty much knew pretty quickly that we were going to be just looking at symbols, and looking at visual aspects of campus. And so we just collected a whole bunch of pictures, and we walked around, took pictures, and just basically made an accounting of all of the things that we'd seen. And then we knew that this was going to be more of a piece about theory and thinking about theoretical aspects of it. So we kind of really honed our theoretical perspective, so that way we could figure out how to talk about these things that we were walking around watching seeing on campus. And we took those pictures, and this is the first time I've ever written and actually used pictures in an academic article, to be honest. And we basically just described them about the logos, and took pictures of those, and then described all the places we saw them. We had a few students who were on teams that were able to get pictures of locker rooms to show us those, because we obviously didn't get access to those. I knew about some of them as a former student, and I was like, yeah, maybe you could ask your student if she can go into that locker room to see if that picture's still there that I remember hearing about from my friends when I was a student there. And we talked about it in class, and students would actually come tell us, oh yeah, we saw X over on on West Campus. Go over there to see if you can get a picture of it or go look at it so that way you'll know if it's there or not. And we did, and then and we took pictures of the old logos too. And then because we were so slow moving, we kind of got a bit, we kind of benefited from being so slow moving. We saw the campus kind of change over a year or two period where some of those old logos got taken down and they got replaced by the new logo. And so a lot of our methods was just describing the physical space we were living in and working in and how it was changing over this 1 to 2 to 3 year period.
So did you
And
see any of the, 'cause you talk about the old logo, and you put that old logo here in the manuscript, but then there's another one from that has the 'cause there's a Red Hawks logo, and then there's the logo with the, you know, the stereotypical Indian chief. I guess I'll say that.
Yeah.
And so were there still a lot of those around when you started the project?
There were. So like those are figure one and figure two. I think those are ones you're talking about. And you had a much better term for it, the stereotypical Indian chief. And it was called the chief's head logo when I was a student there, which I kind of like to use because it reminds us of like how dehumanizing of that dehumanizing it is. There were there the tro the logo one. Those were in the athletic department's main office, which was in Millett Hall, which is where the basketball teams and the volleyball teams play. And those were there when I set foot back on campus in 2016, up until last time I talked to Callie about this project was about 4 or 5 months ago, and she said that some of those things had been taken down and that just had the logo on there, just had the new Red Hawk logo or no logo at all in the corners. We do not know about that practice gym one. That's below Millett Hall, and that's a student-only space. And the student that took that picture for us is no longer a student. She graduated, thankfully, for her. I don't think Callie's been able to get anybody else to check for her. But she does talk about this in class every semester, and she said nobody has brought it up, which we might be able to infer that maybe that it finally got painted over. Some of the other places we saw, like I think we say in the article, I know we do. I just can't remember which page it's on. The right field, the power alleys in the baseball fields, had the Chiefs head logo in the power alleys, and then one day, seemingly overnight, those got taken down, and the Miami Heritage logo got put up. The thing that I noticed, which was interesting, was students, more students seemed to be wearing the old logo as I got there earlier. And
Interesting.
yeah, and I don't, I mean, I've got some theories, but none of them, I've not really thought about enough to kind of like make any public statements about them other than it's to me, it echoes some of the ways in which people are really strongly doubling down on the tomahawk chop, which there are some studies indicate that there is some pleasure to be found by white folks to do that. To me, I could read it that way, but I don't want to impose that sort of intent on my stu on folks without being able to literally talk to them and ask them about why they're doing that.
Right. So let's talk about things like the tomahawk chop. What's the history of using Native American imagery in college sport? What do we know about the issues? Because I know, like, if you go to a Fighting Illini game and it's getting close, they start doing that. Like, we can see that in college sport. We saw this in the World Series with the Braves.
Yeah.
But in at the college level, like, what is the Native American imagery used, and how like common is it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, within the last 10 years, Miami hockey, men's hockey team, there used to be a famous scalpum chant and song that the students would do. And the university finally put their foot down about 9 years ago and made them stop.
And they would just remove people who were doing it, or
They
fine them,
didn't
or
punish them as much as they just basically reminded them over and over again not to do it. And finally, the students, I guess, just got annoyed with it, so they stopped. And it got such bad local public press that they were embarrassed enough by it about. Yeah. And I think they would kick a few students out, but nobody got fined and nobody got kicked out for the rest of the season. It was just like, all right, you got to go for the rest of the day.
Right.
This is game. We'll see you next week. Just don't do it again. Mm-hmm. But like in general, so like the broader history, the Atlanta Braves were in Boston first, and they changed the name to 1912 to the Braves. And I think it was like the Bean Eaters or the Red Stockings that had multiple different kinds of names, you know, in that era where a bunch of these teams were trying out mascot names and some of them didn't stick. And the Cleveland Indians got their name, I think, in 1915, 1916, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And so like this time period in the first two or three decades of the country, a lot of schools and sports teams were using Native American imagery and mascotry, and also a lot of commodified goods like motorcycles, tobacco, butter, like Land O'Lakes butter is the one I use. My dad actually worked for Land O'Lakes butter, and then they finally got rid of their Native American mascot just a few years ago. But these things come back from the late 1900s. And most of the argument is, or at least from what I've been able to gather, is that it was a way to demonstrate sort of American masculinity might, because you depict these peoples, these Native American peoples, who were defeated by whites, because around this time there was a lot of folks talking about Native Americans as being a dying race, mm-hmm. Or a dead race, which has remnants of like eugenics that were happening around that time as well. Yeah. And the fact that if you prop them up as braves or as warriors or as these noble fighters, it makes white American men and masculinity stronger because they were able to beat these people, right? Hmm. In battle. And so they're being commodified and represented in that way, but in ways that really reproduce and center whiteness and capitalism and capitalist relationships. And this also, at the same time, there's this long history of Native American imagery being used to represent Americanness in kind of difference of Britishness. Mm-hmm. So like you had people dressed up like Native Americans for the Boston Tea Party, right. For example, for those things like that. And then also sometimes Native Americans were used as a way to signal like political parties or secret clubs would utilize Native American language or terminology as well. And so all that was kind of happening. And in the 1910s and 20s is sort of when it, and 30s is when it really coalesced, especially around sports teams. So there's a lot of schools that took up the mascots. I think I said earlier, Giuliano wrote about it. And she was mostly focusing on the football, like the faux Indian bodies, who and songs that we'd be playing during football games in the Midwest, primarily. Miami University was founded in 1809. We like to say that we were founded in before Florida was a state, because we were founded in 1809. And we are the real Miami because of that. Mm-hmm. But it's named after the Miami Indian tribe, who were there and were big anti-colonists, fighting in what is now Ohio in the late 18th century. And so there's been Native American sort of mascotry and imagery applied to Miami University since its very outset, with the name being a anglicized version of their name. There's a few like Little Miami and Little Maumee and rivers around the area too. So it's always been associated. And then in that same time period, two of our biggest rivals, you had University of Cincinnati calling themselves the Bearcats and Ohio University calling themselves the Bobcats. And so this myth on campus that the name Redhawks came about like organically, There's also some primary evidence that we cite in the piece through Taglia and Harris, who were Othello Harris is a professor at Miami and a great sociologist of race and sports that's been there for since the 90s when I was an undergrad. I don't know if you'd like me to say it that way. But they wrote this really great piece that found that there's actually PR and marketing, that they came up with a name. They used the old mascot name, the old racist slur, as a way to differentiate themselves from the Bobcats and the Bearcats. And also you have like that stereotype in that of, you know, Native Americans are going to be hunting red Bobcats and Bearcats. So it helps with that sort of terminology as well. Yeah. So like that's when it came out of Miami. But in the years before that, like if you look back at like primary sources from the late 1800s, when Miami came back after the Civil War, because it kind of shut down because it's just not many students were there. There was a lot of like Native American imagery that came up in like student publications, like their lit review, their campus newspapers, their bands. So like there was always kind of this unofficial relationship to the color red and to Native American imagery.
Yeah, it's interesting. Up until this moment, I always knew that there was a University of Miami and Miami University, but I was like, why are those people in Ohio calling it Miami University? And I just always let it go. But that that makes a lot of sense.
Well, there is a story that Philip Shriver, the same guy that we wrote, that one of the few guys that's written history on Miami University, and the student center is called the Shriver Center. He was a beloved history professor, but also college president in the mid to late 20th century. And he even taught as an emeritus up until like 2008, 2009, one of the most popular classes on campus. But he says that the names of the towns in Ohio, or in Florida, were named Ohio-like because a lot of the people that worked down there to build the early railroads in Florida were from Ohio. So you've got Daytona Beach instead of like, which is Dayton. You got Alima, Florida, and Alima, Ohio. The terminus is Miami. And his argument is that it's all just people copying Ohio. I don't know if he's right, but it's something that we very much like to tell ourselves.
It's a good story to tell.
It is.
So we've kind of hovered around this about the Heritage logo, and clearly like Miami made a change. So they added this Miami Heritage logo. Can you talk about the history and the logo and like, what does it mean?
Yeah, definitely. And this was one of the sections that this would have been great if we could have gotten Callie on. I know that she's excited about what we're doing, because this was one of the things that she was really fascinated with and did a lot of really interesting work. The logo if figure three is the main one, and it's the one that also has the, and I'm going to not do a great job with his name, but has the word Niata Wantaniki, which is a Miami word that's loosely translated or Miami University translated into learning from each other. And it is two diamonds facing each other. One of them is black and one of them is red. And in the middle is a white square with a red dot in it. And it is a reference, and it's built off of this really cool artwork from the Miami tribe called Ribbon Work, where they have been doing it for as far as we know, have been doing it for as long as they've been saving this stuff. It's been a long tradition, and it's this beautiful sort of ribbon work that looks a lot like that logo, where folks will sort of intertwine, layer pieces of ribbon to create geometric designs in clothing, blankets, shoes. There's some really cool like moccasins that use it. Tapestries for the wall, all sorts of great. And so it's like this, it's a big part of Miami art, Miami art culture, and just lived experiences and life. And so it's an important component. And now what the red sign, let me make sure I get this right. The black logo is supposed to represent the depths of time, earned respect, and accumulated cultural wisdom and recognized the tribe's deep ties to their historical time homelands. So that's the one on the left, and it's kind of an elongated diamond. And then the one on the right is the red one, and it's responsibility, sacrifice, and a commitment to gain and share knowledge, which is, you know, is like one of the hallmarks of what a university is supposed to be about.
Yeah.
And then the middle one is this white square supposed to represent this shared vision, clarity of vision, and this respect for each other. So sometimes the black part is talked about as being representative of the tribe, and the red part's the university, and it's coming together. And then the red dot in the middle of that white square is a campfire for them to hover around together in warmth and knowledge, because, you know, the symbol of light in a dark land is like enlightenment.
Right.
So that's what that's supposed to represent, and I think it's a really beautiful design, to be honest, and very like elegant, without being too overstated.
Right. Absolutely.
And it was you and Olds, I think Julie Olds, am I getting that name? Yeah, Julie Olds, I'm sorry. I want to make sure I got her name right. She was one of the folks who helped kind of popularize it from the Miami tribe. She's a cultural resources officer. And everything we found, it looks like the university really kind of worked with Miami tribe to put it together.
Mm-hmm.
The other logo, though, is the turtle, the secondary logo, which, as we wrote in there, it incorporates that logo, the rimwork logo, into the shell of the turtle. Right. And this the turtle was a little more popular because there's a very popular campus statue where in one of the main quads that traditionally you walk by, and there's like six turtles around this really cool sundial, you know, this circular sundial, or global sundial, I should say. And the campus lore is that you rub the turtles' heads for luck before your exam.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some sort of notion of like some Native American cultures call like North America Turtle Island, and as a kind of a reminder of different notions of ownership, but also different ideas of religious stories of creation, because we couldn't really find other than the Miami University and the relationship to the turtle, we couldn't find anything specific that spoke to the turtles and Miami.
Right.
So we think it's a very purposeful joining of a Miami University tradition with a Miami tradition.
Huh. So I guess after reading the article, I can clearly understand that the idea of the university in developing the Miami Heritage logo was to acknowledge the kind of contested past, celebrate the connections with the Miami people. And you said that there were people working with the university in designing this. And the symbolism of learning from each other and the other things that you just brought up do sound like what you should be doing at universities. But you also bring up a lot of important questions to be asked about who benefits from these symbolic changes. So can you walk us through some of the questions and tell us about the implications that these changes can maybe bring up?
Yeah. You're exactly right. The marketing for this was fantastic. And it made a lot of us old alumni feel kind of fuzzy and warm, like finally Miami's doing something right by the tribe that they've displaced and basically stole land from in the 1800s and never really paid them back. And so it did feel like it was a great, great first step. And then when you kind of scratch the surface a little bit, you realize that like this November 2019 was the Tribe University Week, the Celebrating Miami Tribe University Week. And a lot of the sports teams, quote unquote, paid tribute to the relationship by using the Miami Tribe Heritage logo on their jerseys, putting them on their football helmets. The football helmet even made, there's a small segment on ESPN about the football helmet and across social media platforms for a bunch of other sports networks. Scratch the surface a little bit and you start to realize, wait a second, who does actually benefit from this? We can definitely see how the university, or at least a few of the ways the university is benefiting. Right. And Chief Langford is saying that the tribe is benefiting from being associated to this university. But what else is out there? Like, what beyond this PR move is happening? Mm-hmm. And so we were thinking about this term racial capitalism, which we use Nancy Leong's version of it, that idea of benefiting financially from a racialized other. Mm-hmm. Nancy Leong has written about it, she's also a legal scholar, but she's written about it on college campuses about how some universities will literally Photoshop a person of color into imagery on a crowd to make the campus look more racially diverse. And so Miami University is a incredibly white university. In terms of racial demographics, it is over 80% white, and it has been at least that much for a long time. And so it has a very white middle class alumni base. And so we were kind of thinking, well, this just seems like it is selling diversity back to a white audience for white people to feel comfortable about how white their university is. Hmm. And so that was one of our initial questions, is like, is that true? And we just kind of sketched it out. They're both benefiting from this development and the logo, the collection of products, some of the selling of the products. Like, Cali cannot get over the fact that there is a Miami Heritage logo cornhole set that you can buy. We tried to find a good picture of it but we could not find one that we weren't sure that we were breaking copyright mm-hmm. in sharing at the university or at the, but they, that was the one that kind of pushed her over the edge about just, I can't believe how ridiculous this is. But we were just wondering about who benefits from this and how do they benefit. And so what does it mean for a incredibly white university that at the time when we were there at school was having actively racist incidents on campus, where administration was almost each semester having to send out an apology to black students about racism on campus. What does that indicate, and how does this PR move work racially? And so we got into some deeper questions. But yeah, the who benefits thing, the interest convergence, because that main theme of tribal crit theory was, how can Native Americans and Native American groups partner with universities? And at what point do those interests stop converging? And so the PR firm was the PR move was definitely about the tribe saying, we're really happy to be a part of this university and be associated with the university, and the university saying, we're very happy to reconcile and continue to improve relationships between the tribe and the university, which had been strained for a little bit in the 90s and in the early 2000s. But they were very happy to use this sort of joint project to trumpet the convergence interest. But then once again, there's only a token number of Native American students, especially the Miami tribe at Miami. There are very few black students and other students of color at the university as well. And it is a predominantly white power structure. So even though they say some of the money is going towards Native American groups, what does that mean?
Right.
Most of the money is still going to this white administration and white university, and there is no like wholesale kind of reparations being paid back to the people. So that, like, those were those questions that were evolved out of that.
Yeah, and I think it's a complicated topic, right? Because if you think about this, it's not like all these other universities are going to tribes to reconcile and make new logos and embrace it. So it's a positive thing that Miami University is doing this. But then at the same time, like, to what extent? Like, what's the long-term process of this? And there's other universities out there that are doing much worse things, and
yes.
that, you know, we could go into a university game and kind of, you know, like, I always think of like a foreigner, somebody from like, I don't know, Norway comes in and just like goes to one of these games that they do the tomahawk chop, and they're like, why do you do that? And they're like, oh, we
Yeah.
do this because of it's a tradition. And they're like, well, is it like, are there like Native American people who like are opposed to this? And they're like, oh, I never thought about that, you know? And
Exactly.
but it still keeps on happening. And I wonder, those things are so like ingrained into that sports culture that I think it would be very hard to take them out. Yet we see these, like we see in soccer, like these chants that are against LGBTQ populations that, you know, have been going on in Latin American countries for years and years and years and years. And then this year they're like, okay, you're playing with no audience. Nobody's coming to your game until you stop doing that. And you're going to be fined again if your fans do that. And they just like play in front of no audiences because their fans are racist, or their, or a certain group of their fans are racist or misogynistic or whatever. And they put those penalties in. And I wonder how long it will take for a Big Ten university to close their game to an audience.
Yeah. Well, that's a really good, I mean, that's where like that 2000, I think it was 2005, that NCAA Native American mascot policy was put in place,
mm-hmm.
where NCAA schools couldn't have, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but they couldn't have postseason tournaments if they had a Native American mascot and also didn't have like a special relationship with an affiliated tribe.
Right.
So like that's when some of the smaller schools start to switch their names.
Yeah.
And even like getting rid of like the warrior name, or the College of William and Mary, which was the which was from the Indians and now it's the tribe.
Huh.
And a lot of it was because of that. That was their punishment, was you can't have that postseason gate.
Yeah.
But I think Stephanie Apstein in Sports Illustrated was one of the first things that I've ever, until you just said that, was one of the first like public journalists to say, well, in some of those countries, they're not letting them play in front of a crowd at all as punishment because it hurts their bottom dollar.
Yeah.
And it hurts their home field advantage if they want to win.
Yeah.
Playing in front of nobody. Why doesn't the Major League Baseball do that with the tomahawk chop?
Yeah. Or fast really forward to 2021 when the Washington football team finally was like, okay, there's a lot of other issues happening in this city with our team. We will change our name.
Yeah, exactly. And that was because of years of activist work.
Yeah.
And then they finally got to FedEx and said, and FedEx finally realized they didn't want to be associated with that brand anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that it's a little bit more complicated than that, but that was a big part of it. And you live in that area, so you know that story too.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a really good Native American sports management scholar, Natalie Welch, who teaches at, I think it's Linville University, a small college up in Oregon. And she is Eastern Band of Cherokee Indian, which is the tribal nation that has a relationship with the Atlanta Braves. She's been talking a lot about this on social media, and she's been on some podcasts and radio interviews where she's been talking about those complications and the sort of how do we punish the bad behavior. And she, the last week, she shared a picture of a video, like a 15-second clip of this small college basketball game in Southern Kansas versus a small school in Northern Oklahoma. And I think it was the school in it was happening in Kansas, and the Oklahoma school had a Native American player on their basketball team, mm-hmm. and they were chanting scalp him, scalp him, scalp him, the kid every time he touched the ball. And there was punishment, but it didn't happen until after the game.
Yeah.
And so like it kind of speaks to the, like you said, it's so ingrained in sport culture. And I know a lot of my students, when we talk about these things, they kind of shrug it off as banter, or athletes just, it's like trash talk is just part of the game. Mm-hmm. And getting them to understand that this is more than just trash talk, and maybe even trash talk shouldn't be part of the game.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if I agree with that, but I think we should at least think through it.
Yeah.
If we're going to, especially if you can't trash talk without being racist or sexist or homophobic. But like it does go that extra step, but we don't seem to be willing to stop the games and calling people out during the fact. Yeah. Right before you called today, I saw a video of these people chanting horribly misogynistic thing at this young woman who's on a high school hockey team in Pennsylvania. Like basically they were chanting, rape her, rape her, rape her.
Oh, that's crazy.
At this young woman who was a goalie on this, and she was the only woman on the team because they didn't have women's hockey or girls' hockey at the high school. And the only thing I could think of is where are her, if nobody else, where are her teammates standing up for her or her coach to stop the game and just get rid of those people until the game's over? And
I remember in high school, they had this like, anti-gay kind of chant that they would do at the free throw line for basketball games.
Yeah.
And it was going on for a little while, and the principal literally like walked out on the court and called out the kids who were doing it. And like, it was a normal basketball game. And this is like in the 90s. And just remember like, oh, that's a chant. Like, but now thinking back of what, not necessarily even courage, but the right vision of saying, okay, this is like taking it over the line. Like this is when I need to take a stand and kick out those people who are doing it. And this is a school sanctioned event, you know, and you can't do that.
And we can welcome those people back once they've kind of learned their lesson and have realized what they were doing is wrong. Cause I don't think they're irredeemable. I don't think anybody would think.
Oh, absolutely.
People are irredeemable. But that's such a great example, and it's such a simple thing to do. Or well, it's a difficult thing to do, but it's a simple act of walking out there and just saying, "Guys, stop doing this," or "People, stop, students, stop doing this."
Absolutely. So I have one last question for you, kind of wrapping this up. Can you tell me a little bit about the suggested changes you bring that could help disrupt the power relations and attend to the interests of the Miami Tribe? Like what could be done?
Yeah. So like, kind of like what we just talked about, we saw in the grand scheme of things, we saw that this Miami Heritage logo does reproduce white supremacy and power and a predominantly white institution and like white capitalism. But we also saw it as an important and could possibly a great first step towards disrupting these power structures, right, and benefiting. And so one of the things that both Callie and I talked about is like we respect scholars, and we're often the same scholars that kind of just do an analysis and then we're done. But we at this point, we wanted to see if we could think about some actual steps forward and things like actionable items. And so we wrote a few of these out, and we actually got help from one of the reviewers. They wrote us a third piece of advice or clarified one of ours.
Thanks, reviewer two.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, they don't usually get enough thanks. So like, there's a really powerful like part of the Miami University brand, and they really do like to brand themselves, is this a liberal arts education at a public university. Mm-hmm. And so there's this thing called the Miami Plan, which is a big component for all students. Even if you major in one of the quote unquote professional schools, you still have to take a wide variety of classes, which is one of the reasons why I liked the school when I was looking at this as a high school kid. But we thought that there should be, they should create and require a Miami history or culture class or language class as part of this plan. So like every student that goes to Miami should at least take one Miami history/culture or language class. There should be an Indigenous Studies department there where students could major or minor Indigenous Studies. because there's the Great Miamia Center, where there's folks doing incredible work with kind of saving, I think they use the name saving or finding and reanimating, and these are all, and these are Miamia tribe, our Miami tribe scholars that are doing this work on campus. We thought we should take advantage of it and maybe hire some folks to work there and teach to all Miami students. Mm-hmm. The second thing that we thought about was making language and culture a permanent part of campus. So building on that Miami Center and providing public space reserved for statues and memorials of Miami history and art by members of the tribe, whether it be like a wing at the already, there's a small art center on campus, or creating a whole other museum just for Miami art and center. There is a precedent on campus. I don't know if you know, let me make sure I get his name right. William McGuffey, the McGuffey Readers, which for a long time were the way that a lot of farm kids learned their history. William Holmes McGuffey wrote the, or learned textbooks. My grandpa learned from a William Holmes McGuffey reader. And he was an education professor in an English or education school at Miami is named after him. And there's a small little museum on his behalf on campus. So there is a history, there is a precedent for that on campus to give space over to a prominent aspect of Miami. We thought that like another thing they could do is to include, and this is where one of the reviewers helped us with, is include Miamia language on signs. Mm-hmm. So, and we were originally just thinking, you know, Canada, you have to get French and American in a lot of the places, but they pointed out to a specific school, to Laurentian, has a tri-culture mandate where there's English, French, and their indigenous language from that, or the indigenous language from the people that were living in their community, Anishinaabewan, and that was probably not sounded correctly.
But I mean, there's a precedent to this too internationally of what New Zealand has done to privilege Maori language and Maori culture, and how, you know,
great point.
These languages and traditions are embedded in the national curriculum for physical education or education in general. You have these things that are part of the culture, not just like. And again, like I know that there's scholars that say that it's not, has not gotten far enough, and there's a lot of inequities there still, but there's a huge step there of how to incorporate a native indigenous population who was there before European settlers came over and colonized the country, now that they are kind of working back to that and using that language, all over the place.
That would have also been a good thing for us to have included that president as well. And I could just imagine, for me personally, as someone who spent so much time on that campus and have a lot of fond memories, I can imagine the different signages having the English name and then the Miami name underneath it, or vice versa, have the Miami name on top and a Miami name on top and then each one there.
And use all that money that they're going to make off these new logos.
Exactly. And then we said that they could even admit more students from the Miami tribe. They do, it's generally a cohort of, from what, and this is where my numbers are a little bit old and dated, but from what I remember reading, is between 10 and 15 every year. There's usually about 10 or 15 Miami tribe official members of the Miami tribe that come to Miami, and they generally get a pretty good scholarship as long as they're the merit-based, specific, and all that. But we think they should open up to even more students, and maybe even if the merit-based issues are too strict, maybe lower them even more to allow as many students to come as possible. Make Miamia leaders a permanent part of the university governance going forward. Make sure there's at least 1, 2, 3 members of tribal, like elected members of tribal governance, so they can select them however they want to, that are a part of the board of governors, the board of regents type organization there. Fifth, pay back. Pay them back to the tribe, because There's the Miami tribe in Indiana, officially federal sectioned ones, and then there's also the Miami tribe in Oklahoma. There are some really good outreach for those groups. I know a lot of scholars work with them, like scholars and educators on campus. But give them money. Yeah. And we were thinking of the George Washington Georgetown University's plan recently to pay reparations to the descendants of people who had
built that university,
been enslaved by the university. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we kind of framed it like you and I have been talking about. Like, this is a great first step. Nobody's perfect, especially with a history of genocide and colonization that is America. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's going to be really difficult to pay that back because of that history.
Right.
But this is a really good first step, and we really hope that the university that we both really care about and want to do well and to keep moving in the right direction.
So I said I had one last question, but now I have another question. Have you sent this paper? Like, do you just like print out a bunch of copies and slip it underneath the door of the president and the provost and different people? Like, do you think that they've read this paper, or have you presented on it?
I sent this to, because I'm no longer there. I moved to Rhode Island in 2019. And Callie and I were finishing up, or like we're finishing up the paper 2019-2020 school year. I've sent the picture to a lot of, or the article to a lot of my friends who are alums. Mm-hmm. And a lot of students of mine have sent it their way too. And I've shared it and on social media, but I have not gone as far as what I'd like to do is I kind of would like to print them out. I know that Callie has presented on it on campus in her own way. Like, she does it, she teaches about it in her classes, and she has given a few formal presentations on campus, is what I should say. But I don't know if anybody above like the department chair of the department we used to work at has actually read it. I know that we've made it available, but we should just print it out. Yeah.
That's a power structure piece on like the 17th level of, you have an author at that university who wrote this article. You yes. left, you're Rhode Island. You're like, hey, yes. you can't do anything. But you know, like an athletic director or an associate AD, like to read this would be, I don't know how they take it, but I think it would be really interesting for them to read it. And I bet you that most athletic directors don't read academic papers about the stuff, you know, like they're so busy doing other things. So it would be interesting. You could have them all read it, interview all of them, write a second paper.
Yes. Well, we are wondering what to do next. That's a good, I'll put that down as the next option. Chief Larkin and President Crawford did come out with a story. I think it was in either higher ed or, you know, one of those like industry papers that all of us academics get emails about. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the Chronicle, but it was one of the other ones. And Callie did send it to me, and we debated whether we should just post the paper on the comment section. But I know I didn't. And I think that was the week that she submitted her tenure portfolio. So she was a little busy doing other stuff.
Yeah, so just send it like in a year.
That's what I told her. She's like, yeah, maybe I will. And I know that as part of your tenure portfolio, the president's going to speak to you one way or the other. So hopefully she'll get in there. But you're right. Like that power structure is there. And she has jokingly been told by people, and I hope it's jokingly, because it'd be a shame for them to lose her because of how great work she does. But she's been jokingly, people said, you should have done this after tenure. And I don't know about you, but I think this is a pretty fair paper.
No, absolutely it is. Yeah.
Actually.
And I learned a ton from this paper, and it made me think a lot. And I think and I'll put the full link to the paper in the notes section so people can read it and click on the paper and see the logos that we've been talking about and both staring at, but in an audio podcast doesn't really come out the same. So
no, well, I mean, and it was, I really appreciate you reaching out to talk about this, and also just the kind words you said about it in this good conversation, because I don't know if it came across, but this was really like a labor of love for me, because mm-hmm. I really do, all things, I've really enjoyed my time in Miami, and I really want them to live up to some of their standards that they hold for other people and for themselves in many other ways. I want them to continue doing that work and get better from this side too, because they're on the right track, I think, and I hope.
And it looks like they're moving forward.
It's great talking to you about this.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. Appreciate your time. I also want to thank Alba Rodriguez for her help in helping produce the podcast. And that's all we got this week. Thanks. If you're still listening, you're probably really into health and physical education. So I'm going to use this opportunity to pitch our master's program to you if you don't have your master's degree yet. Our 100% online master's degree program we offer at George Mason is affordable. You can do it while teaching, and it's high quality. Mason was listed as one of the top 50 universities under 50 years old in the world. Our education department was ranked in the top 10 nationally for the online master's degree program in curriculum and instruction. The master's degree revolves around your teaching. So you'll use assignments from the classes to immediately apply research and best practices to your classes. You'll be part of a tight-knit cohort of health and physical education professionals who are passionate about teaching. You're also going to get an opportunity to interact with students in other content areas. So if you're interested, you can email me, look me up on Twitter, or you can go on the hpewebsite.com under Study With Us and watch a video that I've made.